This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, your audio guide to the latest and most intriguing stories in science and technology, as gathered and reported by the staff of New Scientist magazine. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the April 28th edition of SciPod, a virtual romance, why online wooing is better than the real thing. A shot at the dark, the case for a universe without dark matter. And does subliminal advertising really work? Popcorn? We'll have the answer in this week's Soft Drink Science News. But first, birds do it, bees do it, and it seems scientists just can't stop being curious about it. It, of course, is falling in love. And this week, New Scientist brings you a special issue all about the science of modern love. You'll find stories that explore how genetics and the sense of smell help us find our mates, how to predict whether a marriage will last, and how the Oscar-winning film Brokeback Mountain may have got it wrong when it comes to the neuroscience of same-sex relationships. The special also takes a look at how technology is changing the way we woo. And to find out more about online romance, Ivan Semenek spoke to New Scientist technology reporter Celeste Beaver.
Celeste, I know in researching this story, you ran into people who had some very interesting personal experiences and for whom the internet played a big role in their developing relationships. Can you give us one of those stories, one of the things you ran into?
I spoke to a couple called Garth and Patuka who had met inside a virtual world called Second Life. Second Life is a virtual game where people are represented by sort of cartoon figures of themselves called avatars. And they go there and they sometimes spend 8 or 10 hours there. They can build virtual worlds. They build houses, boats, airplanes. They're part of guilds. They can start companies. They can make clothes. They can sell their clothes. And these were two people who, one was based in California, the other based in London in the UK, who were both playing the game, and they met at a virtual 4th of July party watching some virtual fireworks and sort of chatted to each other a little bit and started hanging out together, and then at some point decided to start dating inside the game.
And so then how did that translate into a real-life encounter?
Well, they started doing more and more of these kind of activities together, and then finally the man, Garth, asked Patuka to move in with him. He had built himself a house and was living in a house, and she was living in some kind of dock by a bay. So she moved in with him inside the game, which basically meant that that's kind of where they both hung out for some of the time in the game and where their sort of home base. And then they got married inside the game, which involves telling the game organizer that you want to get married, and then your two game accounts get fused together. And then a year later, after they've been married in the game for about 9 months, and sometimes spending 8 to 10 hours a day in each other's company, either communicating by typing messages in on the keyboard or on the computer-mediated telephone call, they finally decided to meet. And Patuka, the girl, flew to London and met Garth. And they actually got on really well in real life. And now they're getting married in real life.
You know, it's just such a remarkable head-spinning story because, you know, on one hand, they're living this virtual life to the extent that they're a married couple, but all of this happens before they meet in real life, but they find that they're compatible and now they're going to get married for real. I suppose it's not a surprise that they find themselves compatible after investing so much time together, but, you know, how unique is this story? Is this typical or does this happen, has this happened in Second Life before? You know, how frequent is this kind of thing?
A lot of getting married inside the game is extremely frequent. Basically, people are spending some people are spending 8 or 10 hours a day inside the game. And so just like in real life where they want to have a girlfriend, boyfriend or husband, they want to have someone in the game that they're associated with, that the people they meet, that they know those two people are together and sort of a formal expression of their relationship. So that's very, very common. And then translating that to outside the game, I actually spoke to one other couple who'd also done that. And the game organizers don't really know how common that is, but anecdotally, you know, it certainly is happening as well.
Now, of course, finding the right mate is a quest that, you know, goes back to the beginning of our species. the internet, the web environment is a kind of a new space in which that age-old quest can play out. You know, in the bigger picture, do you have a sense of how many people, how many internet users are going online to find their mates?
Yeah, there was a survey done by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and they found that 74% of single internet users in the U.S. have taken part in at least one online dating type of activity, and 15% of American adults say they know someone who's been in a long-term relationship with someone they met online, and I think that amounts to about 30 million people.
Do you think there's something different about the way people can interact with each other online as opposed to the way they might interact face-to-face?
Yes, there is something very different, and a lot of sociologists and psychologists are really interested in this because they say that there's some things about online that are more conducive to a romance developing. Things like the fact that you're very anonymous can encourage people to be much more daring and flirtatious and to say things that they wouldn't dare to say in real life because of the physical repercussions. Someone might see them, someone they know might see them, they could be identified later. But because they're willing to go for these kind of daring comments, often romances and intimacy develop a lot faster. And there's also been studies showing that people are more honest, again, because they're anonymous and because they're not exposed to the facial expressions, maybe disapproving facial expressions of people around them. And they're also focusing more on what they're saying. They're not worried about what they look like or being shy. They can just focus on sort of constructing a response to a question or making statements about themselves. And all of that can lead people to actually become more intimate more quickly online.
I guess part of the reason why we're talking about this is, in a sense, online dating is such a new idea still. And even though many people, as you say, either have been in these relationships or they know people who have long-term relationships based first on an online connection, it's still a novelty in some ways or a curiosity. Do you ever foresee a future where this is going to be the kind of prime or obvious way for people to find their mate?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people it will be. I mean, it's so attractive because you don't have any geographical restraints and you're just exposed to this huge pool of people. And those people can easily be divided up into interests. You can easily screen out a lot of people, and yet you can home in on just the ones that you're maybe more likely to get along with. But certainly for the online dating sites, they're probably going to have to improve a lot if people are going to start relying on them. Because although you are exposed to this big pool of people, I think the devil is in sorting them out. And that actually seems to work better inside the games where people have shared experiences together and go out and do things. Whereas in the online dating side, it's more like a catalogue of someone's hobbies, which doesn't seem to be a particularly good predictor of chemistry between two people. Whereas in the virtual worlds, people have a chance to kind of experiment with chemistry and see if they have a rapport with someone rather than just looking them up in a catalogue. So I think it could take off, but I think that the dating sites need to maybe create an experience a little bit more like the virtual world than just a catalogue of hobbies.
Well, thanks very much, Celeste, for being our real-life guide to this fascinating domain of the virtual world.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Technology reporter Celeste Beaver spoke to us from Boston. Her story about online relationships is just one of the features in this week's special Love Edition of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now from the London office of New Scientist, here's Caroline Williams with this week's science news.
Scientists have reached a major milestone in their quest to bore through the Earth's crust. For the first time, a drill has made contact with the gabbro layer that lies beneath much of the world's oceans. Gabbro is a dense, coarse-grained rock that forms under mid-ocean ridges when trapped magma slowly cools down. It's thought that a sampling of the gabbro layer will shed new insights into how ocean crust forms. Researchers at the University of California at Santa Barbara drilled into the Pacific Ocean floor at a site located 800 kilometers west of Costa Rica. At times, the tough rock only allowed them to drill 10 meters per day. Eventually, after drilling nearly 1.2 kilometres, the drill hit gabbro, and researchers were able to bring samples to the surface. As impressive as that is, the depth reached by the drill is less than a quarter of the way to the Earth's mantle, the ultimate goal for the drilling project. Sheep may not have a reputation for being the brightest animals in the farmyard, but a new study suggests that they may have hidden talents, including the ability to prescribe their own medicine. Researchers at Utah State University gave lambs food laced with one of three different additives that made them feel unwell. The lambs were then given something to eat that would alleviate their symptoms. After this learning process, the lambs were given food containing one of the three substances that had disagreed with them, and a choice of three medicines. Compared to a control group, the lambs that had been sick once before showed a clear preference for the correct remedy. The study seems to add weight to anecdotal reports that primates also engage in self-medication by selecting special plants to eat when something has made them feel sick. And finally, back in 1957, a market researcher named James Vickery claimed he could get moviegoers to buy popcorn and soft drinks simply by flashing messages on the big screen. The flashes were too short to register as conscious perceptions, but the idea was that they'd be acted on as subliminal suggestions. Vickery later admitted his study was faked, and over the years, attempts to replicate its effects have failed. But now, a team in the Netherlands has shown that if conditions are right, subliminal advertising does work. Subjects were first given a very salty snack, and then asked to look at flashing screens, showing uppercase and lowercase letters. Although they didn't know it, they were also being shown a message to drink a particular brand of soft drink. Afterwards, they were far more likely to choose that soft drink over a competing brand. According to researchers, the study shows that people can be primed with subliminal messages as long as those messages are relevant to an existing goal. In other words, a subliminal message won't make you thirsty, but if you are thirsty already, it may tell you what to drink.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show. Despite the fact that it's never been detected, a mysterious substance known as dark matter now plays a key role in our understanding of the universe. But what if it's all just one big illusion? These days, a few renegade cosmologists are pursuing an alternative to dark matter called MOND. And recently, MOND has been gaining converts. This week's edition of New Scientist includes a feature article all about MOND. For an overview, Ivan spoke to physicist James Binney at the University of Oxford.
Dr. Binney, like everyone else, I've never seen dark matter, but I guess after years of reporting on it, I've gotten comfortable with imagining that the universe is full of particles that don't emit light or interact with other matter except through gravity, and collectively we call that stuff dark matter. If I now switch to the MOND way of looking at the universe, what alternative picture should I be imagining?
Well, if you reckon you only detect dark matter through its gravitational field, you're dependent for that detection upon the theory of gravity. Most people still feel that we do have a good theory of gravity, which is Einstein's modification of Newton's theory of gravity. But supposing this theory hasn't been empirically tested in a wide range of circumstances, so we're very much dependent on extrapolations, theoretically motivated extrapolations of what we securely know about it from our experiments on Earth and in the solar system and so on. And if that extrapolation is incorrect, then you would infer the existence of dark matter through the use of an incorrect theory, matter which isn't actually there. So the alternative is that one has a different theory of gravity.
So I gather we're looking at a different kind of gravity and, in a sense, a theory of gravity that would be similar to, Einstein's general relativity and close quarters, within the solar system, but at great distances, galactic distances, it would be different. Now, for physicists who've jumped sides, or at least who've gotten curious enough about MOND to look at it seriously, what is it about that approach that's more appealing than dark matter?
Well, I think that historically, it's probably worth looking at historical development. Back in 1983, Monty Milgram of the Weizmann Institute suggested that that rather than just rushing into assuming that there is dark matter. So, as it were, dark matter arrived on the agenda very firmly in the 1970s, the late 1970s, through studies of groups of galaxies, through studies of the rotation curves of galaxies at large radii and so on. And a consensus was building by about 1980 that there was a great deal of dark matter. And what Milgram said was, well, hang on a moment, it isn't self-evident that what we have here is evidence for dark matter. Shouldn't we just look at the possibility that what's needed is a modification of the theory of gravity? And he produced a modification. It was then refined in another paper with Jacob Bekenstein. And that theory didn't find much resonance, especially in the community of physicists. But some astronomers took it sort of seriously enough that they were willing to analyze data as they came in the following 20 years or so from the perspective of Mond. And by about 2000, a surprisingly large body of evidence has accumulated.
So I'd like to get into that a little bit. You were saying earlier about what some of the initial observations were that brought about an acceptance of, or sort of a broad acceptance of dark matter in the 1970s. You talked about rotation curves of galaxies, for example. Essentially, the way visible matter moves seems unusual, and something about that motion suggests there must be more matter that we can't see. So it sounds like Mond is tackling that kind of observation pretty well, but there are other things that we now ascribe to the effects of dark matter. For example, the way there's gravitational lensing, you know, the way we see the light of distant quasars being bent around clusters of galaxies, and also about the background, the cosmic microwave background. How is that handled by Mond, these other lines of evidence?
Well, for a long time, essentially it wasn't. Until March of last year, there really was no proper way of handling things like the growth of cosmological structure or the gravitational deflection of light, because all that was on offer, the Milgram, Bekenstein-Milgram theory, was sort of Newtonian mechanics. It was non-relativistic. They were aware that it wasn't satisfactory in the sense it was non-relativistic. And so when you were dealing with, for example, the bending of light, which is obviously propagated by photons, photons are relativistic particles, the quintessential relativistic particles, their theory just didn't apply, and it obviously some extension was needed to deal with that. And for many years, people struggled, a small group of people struggled to find a generalization of the Bekenstein-Milgram sort of idea that would be relativistically covariant to the technical term, so would be consistent with what we understand about relativity. And without success, and a sort of rumor had grown up, a sort of feeling had grown up, well, probably there is no such theory. It's just not possible to construct a theory which involves a characteristic acceleration and is consistent with relativity. And I think my point of view, and I think the point of view of a number of other people, was significantly changed when Bekenstein produced a theory which had these essential ingredients.
Are there future observations or tests that would actually settle the debate, that would allow us to critically decide whether dark matter or Mond was in fact the correct model?
I don't think this will be easy. I think what's mostly wanted at the moment is more theoretical work to pursue, well, first of all, to find out what is the range of what Einstein-like theories are there which provide a Mondian low energy, so would account for the phenomenology of galaxies. And on the other hand, what are the predictions of these kind of theories for cosmology, for the microwave background? So at the moment, the intellectual tools are there, but they have not been worked out. The conventional Einsteinian dark matter people have worked for 20 years or so, well, 25 years more like, on the development of their cosmology. And so they have a very sophisticated theory and understanding of all of this. And it's been a big community that's put that together. It will take a long time and a good deal more work than has gone into it at the present, so far, for people working with alternative gravity theories to develop the predictions of their theory in these areas.
And I'm wondering how you would characterize the mood in the community about all of this. I mean, there's certainly been a sense in recent years that a standard cosmology has been coming together around dark energy, dark matter. Results from experiments like WMAP and so on seem to be building a consistent picture. So when people come along with a completely alternative way of looking at the universe, is that a welcome argument? Is it awkward? Is it heavily resisted?
the conventional, I mean, the people who've obviously given their professional lives, their scientific careers to developing the conventional dark matter theory are by and large not willing to take Mondrian developments very seriously. They think that these difficulties that dark matter has on small scales will be sorted out by further work and so on. And the community people who are interested in pursuing the Mondrian alternative is undoubtedly small. I think it's disappointingly small in the sense that there's a great deal of work. I think the work ought to be done, and it isn't going to be done in a hurry if there aren't a fair number of people working on it. On the other hand, I think, Matt, there are a significant number of people who are interested in, you know, mathematical physics, the theory of everything or whatever, who feel that modification of gravity along the lines that Bekenstein is suggesting is perfectly natural from the point of view of effective field theories. So when you think about what gravity would look like when properly quantized, so they're very willing to entertain these sorts of ideas.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Binney, for walking us through what is, as you say, an unclear situation. I guess it'll be very interesting to see what happens next.
It will. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
James Binney is a professor of physics at Oxford University. You can find out more about Mond in this week's issue of New Scientist magazine. And that wraps up this edition of SciPod. But it's only the beginning of what you can find in the April 29th New Scientist. Also in this week's issue, gasping for breath. China's reliance on coal means it now produces more sulfur dioxide than any nation on Earth. And it's heading for a serious health crisis. Talk to the Palm. How language learning software can turn a handheld computer into a two-way translator. And flying carpet to Pluto. A giant flexible solar panel unfurled in space could one day power a trip across the solar system. All this plus lots more science and technology, news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.